Now, we continue our mini-series on the shoulders of giants, in which Mooney Goes Wild reporter and biologist Terry Flanagan highlights some of the many research projects being carried out here in Ireland, where academics use the understanding gained by major thinkers from the past to learn more about the natural world and build up our body of knowledge into the future. Today, we visit the zoology department in Trinity College Dublin. Sam Preston has just begun his PhD studies on dietary conservatism, something that you and I might describe as picky eating, a phenomenon we probably thought only occurred in difficult children. Not so, says Sam, because over the last number of years, it has been shown that dietary conservatism occurs in many species of mammals, birds, fish, and even in some insects. Sam wants to know more about how organisms learn to decide on what to eat, and more importantly, what not to eat.
I'm working on the three-spined stickleback, a native Irish species.
Which we used to call pinkeens many, many years
back
ago.
Back in the day, because of the red belly of the males when they're mating.
That's it. And what are you doing with them?
I'm looking at their diet. I'm looking at dietary behaviour. Specifically, I'm looking at dietary conservatism. Imagine you've got picky eaters and non-picky eaters.
Right.
So you're picky
eaters. Like as in children.
Exactly like with children. So imagine you give a new food to a fish and it takes it immediately. It's very happy to eat this new food. It's not very picky. But some fish are very picky and you give them a new food and they won't eat it.
Right.
And they won't eat it for a very long time. And it's not just fish. It's fish, birds. In fact, it's every animal that's been tested for this behavior of refusing new foods has found that some of them are picky and they won't eat it.
I suppose the classic example would be rats. And I'm thinking particularly of rat poison.
Absolutely. People think of avoiding the new thing. They think of rats because rats are a classic model for neophobia. Neophobia and dietary conservatism.
Right. Well, what's neophobia then?
Neophobia is this fear of the new.
Right.
Fear
okay.
of the novel. So you put out poison for a rat and the rat sees this in its environment and it's new. So the rat goes, I'm not going anywhere near that. But now imagine that that rat doesn't just avoid the novel poison, but it avoids novel foods for a very long time, even after it stopped really being new. And it's not really afraid of it. It's just not eating it.
And you're doing this study on these fish. Why fish?
Fish are a really suitable organism to work with. They're a great model organism because you can keep lots of them in a lab. They are known to have this dietary conservatism behavior. They're very well known in their behavioral biology, so there's a lot of existing literature and knowledge out there to work with. There's a wealth of knowledge of how to keep and breed them. We have their DNA sequence, we have their genome sequence. They've been used as a behavioral model for lots of different things. It's just fantastic to have kind of a background to be able to build on rather than working with a new fish from the start and knowing nothing about it or why it was doing certain things.
And really what you're trying to do is you're trying to teach them not to be conservative.
I'm trying to find out if there are ways that they learn to not be conservative.
Because that would be an advantage to them.
It absolutely would be. But it also works in the reverse. Imagine you have a situation where you want to protect your crops and you've got a pest like starlings, for instance. If we could harness the DC individuals that don't like new crops, suddenly you plant something new there, or maybe you've just coloured the food somehow with a harmless dye, then maybe the DC individuals could lead all the other individuals away in search of food that they're familiar with. Mm-hmm. So it actually works in both directions.
You must have had an interest in fish before now, because it's not something that most people really have an interest in. Tell us the background.
Oh, why wouldn't you have an interest in fish? I grew up on David Attenborough Trials of Life, and I was lucky enough to grow up by the seashore as well.
Right.
So rock pooling was something I did all the time. I didn't go fishing, but I'd go lifting up every big rock looking for eels, gobies, blennies, crabs, anything at all. And I thought I was going to be a marine biologist when I was 4. And when I got to Trinity eventually, I studied zoology. I did some marine biology, but I discovered that I really liked evolution and behaviour, which is kind of like current evolution, what things are doing now, why they're doing it.
But in one sense, you're not really studying the fish, you're just using them as a model for your behavioural work.
Exactly. So while I am working with fish, which is kind of like my first passion, I'm actually using them to study a much broader concept, and that is how things decide what to eat, how things learn what to eat, and ultimately, I hope, how those decisions affect population survival and their ecology and how they function in the wild.
Now, you've only just started this project, but you have done some work on it for your master's.
Yeah, I did a very similar project for my master's using fish as a model again and looking at groups. It was a very small study, but it showed that some groups of individuals did in fact behave very picky towards the novel food even though they could be learning from one another. Fish see each other mouthing food all the time. They'll pick it up and spit it back out. And they fight over mouthed food as well. So one fish picks up and spits it out. The other one comes along and then eats it. Mm-hmm. So you would think that's a great opportunity for them to learn new foods are okay. But apparently they don't always do that. And I'm very curious as to why.
Now, a lot of people would think that fish are stupid. I mean, how many times have we been told that goldfish only have a memory of 4 seconds?
We've been told too many times because it's not true. Goldfish actually have quite good memories. They can remember what time of the day they get fed and they'll be expecting their food at that time of day. And you can see it if you watch them. My fish are very much the same. You can teach them after a few days of just getting the same color food that this is their food. This is their familiar food and they will prefer it over other foods that you give them. Until you teach them then that the new foods are also okay. So it takes some time for them to learn, but once they do, that knowledge stays.
And you have all your fish here in Trinity?
I do at the moment. There are some downstairs outside and some inside in the lab. Would you like to go and take a look at them?
Absolutely. Lead me to it. So this is your lab?
Yeah, this is the lab. This is a behavioural ecology lab. And here,
it's quite small, actually. I thought it had visions of it being bigger.
Well, the college likes to keep you in as small a space as possible. And I like it. It's a really cosy little lab. And
okay, and here's your fish, are they?
Everything. Here they are. So this guy here, he's not too shy. He's moving a little bit, waving his fins.
Okay, he's blue 013 in, yeah. Whatever that means.
That's okay. Just the notation I've given them in order to be able to term which fish is which from my notes.
Right, okay. And what you have then is you one fish in each container here.
Yeah, so they start off in a group container, but when it comes to individual testing, they go into one single fish to a tank.
Right. Okay, and you feed them on Daphne, I'm told, and these are your Daphne here.
So I've got some of the Daphne I've collected from Herbert Park, actually, in here. They're Daphne and Magna.
And you're hoping to breed these Daphne, is that right?
Yeah, I'm trying to get these guys to create a nice system. I'm basically trying to make a Daphne farm, actually.
Right, okay.
And I've got lots of little trial pots where I try different feeding regimens, different water. And I've even got different strains of Daphne from other researchers in the lab or in the department.
Right.
And
so what you have here is a large number of containers, maybe 10 or 15 containers, and Daphne in each of them with a different food source, is it, for the Daphne?
It's actually different food amounts for the Daphne. Right. I started off with different food sources, but I discovered that feeding them on a mixture of yeast and algae worked really, really well. So they're now all getting yeast and algae, whereas previously it was one or the other.
So really what you're trying to do here is, first thing you're trying to do is you're trying to develop a method of breeding the Daphnia, which is the food source for your fish.
Yes, it would be.
How are you going to colour the Daphnia?
How do I colour the Daphnia? Oh, it's very easy, actually. It's a food colouring. Exactly the same stuff you'd use in baking or making cakes or icing. And you just let the Daphnia sit in this for about 15 minutes and they hold their colour beautifully for well over an hour.
Okay, so that's a blue, that one, and I see
a
black.
I've got a blue
there.
And I've got a black. Okay. We've used other colours in the past, but we're trying these ones at the moment.
So what you hope to do then is you hope to start feeding, training these fish to take different types of coloured Daphne, is that right?
Yes. So the fish you saw in there have been familiarised, they've been trained to either take black or blue. So when you said blue 13, he's been familiarised with blue, that's his familiar colour.
Right.
And black is his novel colour. And then he's been going through testing to see how long it takes him to take the black as readily as he takes the blue. Basically, how long does it take to stop him being picky?
So you're going to train these particular fish to take particular foods. When they've gotten used to taking that particular colour, what are you going to do then?
Well, then they go into their actual testing. You give them an opportunity to eat their familiar food and also the novel food. And you try to work out... Sorry, this is really annoying to explain because it's an evolution test.
Right.
I know I'm getting a bit useless for you here. But basically, you give them a high proportion of familiar food and a low proportion of novel food. And then you see what they eat. You let them eat half of the food. And the next day, you give them the same amount of food, but the proportions are determined by whatever remains the previous day. So in this case, it's 19 familiar, 1 novel. And if they eat 10, let's say they eat 10 familiar, then it's only 9 familiar left and 1 novel left. It goes back up to 20, there'll be 18 familiar and 2 novel.
Okay, so it's quite technical.
It's there's a little bit of maths behind it.
Yeah, statistics.
It's hard to explain, but once you've actually done it a couple of times, it's very straightforward.
Now, how is that going to help you in understanding behavioralism or evolution in fish?
It's going to help me understand whether or not this fish is picky or not, whether or not he's a dietary conservative fish. And if I can develop a robust method for testing quickly whether or not they're dietary conservative, it'll make it easier to make groups of fish where I know whether each fish is going to be picky or not when it comes to a new food. And then I'm going to see how that group responds to new foods if you give them the opportunity to eat them. Do the picky fish learn from the not picky fish, or do the not picky fish copy the picky fish and decide not to eat the novel food at all? These fish are just from the wild, and when they're done here in the lab, we'll be bringing them right back to release in the wild. I've got funding for 3 years for my PhD. Right. If I could get a fourth year as well, that would be fantastic because it'll give me more time to test more things.
And who's funding it?
I'm getting funding from Trinity College, actually. I was lucky enough to receive the Usher Award, which covers my fees and a stipend, but it doesn't give me any operating budget. So I'm kind of working with whatever other researchers have been kind enough to give me.
Okay. That's James Usher, is that right?
Yes, that's the one.
The man of evolutionary fame who said that the Earth was created on the 23rd of October in the year 4004 BC at 12 noon or something like that. That's the man. Irish Archbishop.
It's a little bit ironic that I'm working on this, but I'm not going to argue on that at the moment. We could be here all day.